It's a Cartoon Revolution. I'm Deidre.
And I'm Sonia.
Why Cartoon Revolution?
Because the cartoons we love aren't just for kids anymore.
Cartoons have something to say and change to inspire, and we're here to break it down for you.
Whether it's anime or Pixar, 2D or CG.
Join us as we take cartoons too seriously and discover their hidden meanings and revolutionary ideas. Okay, hi everyone. Welcome to Cartoon Revolution and welcome to our first episode. My name is Deidre.
I'm Sonia. Welcome.
And we're excited to be sharing this space and this time with you. And basically we made this podcast because both Sonia and I love taking cartoons way too seriously. And we're also really interested in social and environmental issues, just basically complex issues. And we wanted to kind of share where all these things that we love intersect.
I feel exactly the same. For me, I would always get really annoyed at my parents when they would see me watching TV and say things like, why are you watching cartoons? You're 25 years old. Like, cartoons are for kids. Like, what are you doing? Don't you feel silly? And that's so irritating to me because I feel like cartoons have so much more to say than a lot of people give credit for. And so many adults, like people our age and even older, love watching them because they're so engaging, they're fun, they're funny, and they do things that are interesting that you can't necessarily see in traditional live action content. So we're here to talk all about that, all of the things that cartoons have to say that other people often ridicule or dismiss or ignore. That's what we're so excited to talk about.
So I wanted to go back to the roots of this podcast and something that both you and I really bonded over, and that's Avatar: The Last Airbender, specifically the episode The Painted Lady. And so let's jump into it. So basically, Avatar The Last Airbender was a show on Nickelodeon. It's finished, and just so everyone knows, we are going to be talking about spoilers, but it finished several years ago, so if you haven't watched it, probably get on that.
There's no excuse. There's no excuse for not watching it.
Yeah, and I picked this episode in particular just because it's like a fun episode, but I guess so many of them are. And I really think it's a good place to talk about the importance of stories and how that translates to action. And just for a brief summary, in case you don't remember what happened in this episode, Team Avatar, or I'm like trying, okay, I literally wrote down in my notes not to say the Aang Gang, because I wanted to, but anyway. So Team Avatar arrives in this small fishing village that is super polluted because of a weapons factory, and hijinks ensue, and basically the group ends up helping this village in multiple ways.
Yeah, it's a really great episode. I remember having to defend to a friend why I love this episode so much. He couldn't understand why it was one of my favorites, and I think the truth is just because it's a Katara-focused episode, and both Deidre and I are just weak when it comes to Katara. We love her so much. But it does have a lot of interesting moral quandaries that I think we're really excited to dive into, particularly around Katara's choice to embody the Painted Lady, right?
So I didn't know that was one of your favorite episodes. So tell me what you liked so much about it. Because I don't know that this was a good one, but I don't know that it stood out the first time I watched the show, to be honest.
Yeah. I think the reason why a lot of people don't like it is it's kind of like a filler episode in the sense that there's nothing like really central to the main plot happening. And I can see how, as a dedicated fan who's like really excited for the solar eclipse and all of these fights with the Fire Nation and Zuko and the Fire Lord coming up and foreshadowed for so long, gets kind of like thrown aside for 1 second so that Katara can have like another moral speech like she does every fourth or fifth episode. But I think the truth is I just love Katara so much, and I think her strength and tenacity is really part of why a lot of young women love this show, and I think she really shines very strongly in this. it also just like seeing the crew come together at the end, it not being just Katara leading everything, but really the team as well, is part of why I really like it. Anyways, let's talk about that. So what would you say is kind of the main morality that Katara kind of brings to this episode? Like, what is she like fighting for?
Well, she, I think, is someone who acts so much on her gut, and like we said, the morality that she holds so central to who she is. And seeing this village that is suffering from the effects of the weapons factory really kind of pushes her to take action.
Yeah, well, I think basically the central argument that Katara and Sokka have in this, wherein Katara says, I can't turn my back on these people. Like, they're clearly desperate. Like, the river is poisoned. The Fire Nation is treating them horribly. They don't have medicine. They're sick. They're poor and hungry. But Sokka's side of the story is, but we have a bigger mission. We don't have time to stop for every single small village. So that's kind of like the moral quandary in this episode, at least as represented by these two characters. You know, Sokka has a point, like they do have to take down the Fire Lord and they can't save every small village. But I think what really makes Katara shine is her stubbornness and sort of seeing the hope that she can bring to the small village and, you know, not turning a blind eye to it. As much as the bigger mission is important, they don't really abandon it, or at least she refuses to abandon it.
Yeah, she throws off Sokka's entire schedule. You know? I love that.
Oh my
that.
Gosh. That was, yeah, you know, it's so funny. I saw, I think it was on the wiki or something. They said that apparently Sokka's schedule is like the actual like production schedule for the episode. So that's why you can see the animation looks kind of different. It doesn't really look like it's in this world. And it's a real schedule. And you can kind of see like the animators sort of, I guess, laughing at, I guess, the busyness of their own life.
I had no idea.
Yeah. And anyways, I think something else that I really like about this episode is it's kind of in line with the Blue Spirit and the Blind Bandit episodes and several other similar episodes in which our favorite main characters kind of take on this alter ego or other identity in order to do some kind of behavior that's maybe not part of their character or like is a part of themselves that they're not able to fully embrace yet. So for those who maybe don't remember, the Blue Spirit is the episode where Zuko wears the kind of Blue Spirit mask and saves Aang from I think it was Admiral Zhao. So he kind of takes his other alter ego in order to save essentially his mortal enemy. And then in The Blind Bandit, that's Toph's first episode where she kind of has this like really tough, like strong earthbender alter ego that her parents know nothing about. So I think there's kind of an opportunity here for these sort of alternate identity kinds of stories for the characters to explore some kind of new nature or part of themselves that we don't really get to see. And that's kind of Katara's kindness and also her power and her strength that is elevated to almost a deity level in this episode.
Right. And I mean, this is a trope that's used in a lot of other animation, cartoon, storytelling. It is that idea that they're exploring a part of themselves that wasn't originally something that was open to them.
Exactly.
But what, yeah, and so why do you think Katara needed, like, what was the what part do you think she was really exploring? Do you think that was the compassion part, or do you think it was something else?
Yeah, I think that's where it becomes a little more gray, because with Toph and Zuko, they weren't taking identities that already existed. They weren't putting their own twist on an identity that already existed. As far as we're aware, there was no other previous Blind Bandit or Blue Spirit. That's identities that they forged. But Katara, for this instance, took some other mythological identity or deity that was very special and important to this village and kind of made it her own. And I think the morality of that gets a little confusing, because I think her intention is very good, but I think Sokka is right, and he brings this up, like, you're essentially lying and deceiving all these people and taking this myth that they really cherish and using it for still good purposes, but in a way that's not necessarily true. And to answer your question, I wonder if the part of herself that Katara was exploring was the dangerous side of empathy, the side that veers too closely to arrogant saviorism rather than empowerment. So I think this was a crucial lesson for Katara to not take things too far, to find a balance between intervention and non-intervention. Because in the end, it is, you know, good to care about people. It is good to help them. But there are instances when I think it's too far. And an example of that is, you know, impersonating someone's deity.
Right. And in that episode when she is revealed, I forget sometimes that the villagers here in this case are Fire Nation, and they were very upset that a southern water tribe, or just like a waterbender, came to, like you said, impersonate someone who mythologically was important to these people. And it also, to me, reminds, or just like makes me think of how sometimes there's this idea that like outside people coming in are like what changes or what is like helpful to the local population, which, I don't know, on a broader sense, I have a problem with. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I think that hits on, you know, the other problem brought up and explored in this episode, which is intervention versus non-intervention. Like, what instances do you have the right to get involved, and what instances should you stay away and let kind of the locals deal with it? And I think, and even in the end, everything kind of wraps up really nicely. Like, yay, they chased off the firebenders, and, you know, they cleaned the river. But we also don't really acknowledge that, you know, a few of those houses were literally like burned down and destroyed. We saw them, like a couple of them, fall into the river. And that wouldn't have happened if you know, these meddling kids hadn't gotten involved, right? So there's kind of, you know, there's something there that's like a little bit like, should they have gotten involved, and was it necessarily right for them? And Sokka, I think, had a point there. Like, should they have really burned down the factory? Was that the way to go? Did that save everyone in the long term? Yeah, I don't know. And who has the right to make those decisions, especially as the Avatar, right? I mean, that's technically his role, is to kind of maintain the balance. But is it maintaining the balance to intervene or not to intervene? Because sometimes the choice is to not intervene.
Right. And I think that there's a good point of comparison, like seeing the Painted Lady at the end and knowing that she was, you know, quote unquote, real. And she did not intervene, as I think a lot of, at least the traditional stories that I heard growing up, and the cultural elements that are imbued in those, is that these deities and these gods, they work in ways that affect us and yet are not there to just solve our problems, right? And I guess the Painted Lady did thank Katara, but she also didn't intervene herself. And yeah, where does Aang fall in that, as the bridge between the two mm-hmm. worlds?
Yeah, I like how you pointed out that scene, because I really liked how we find out that the Painted Lady is real. But I also wonder if that scene was kind of a chance for the writers to say, okay, it was okay that we did that, because it was definitely a sort of ethically gray thing for them to do, you know, get involved and like kind of cause the destruction of part of this village, but still save the day in the end. But still, having the actual deity come by and say thank you is kind of like a, okay, it was okay, good job.
I do, like, it was a satisfying way to end that episode. But whether or not promotes the idea of just like, again, outside people coming to fix things, is, I find, a little problematic. But it was a cool scene. It was it was cool to see the Painted Lady. Also, something that I forgot, you know, while watching the episode, that these people in Zhonghui on the river are citizens of the Fire Nation. And I think there's a myth throughout this whole series, especially told by Fire Nation people on the mainland, that the Fire Nation is the greatest nation and they want to share their greatness with the rest of the world and like bring peace to everyone. And it's essentially a colonialist narrative, and it's not so different than what we see in the real world. And a way to, essentially justify these actions to their own citizens. But it's interesting to see that these people in this village are citizens as well, but they themselves are being taken advantage of. And they're not, even though they are citizens, they're kind of not under the umbrella of people who are benefiting. And I'm not sure if they do this in other episodes, but I just, that to me was something that really stood out and was important to see as part of like the overarching themes in this show.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point and relates to kind of the role of myths in society, but also the different types of myths, because there's manufactured myths and there's kind of real sort of naturally occurring myths. So like when we talk about manufactured myths, that's exactly what you're saying, like the Fire Nation as a concept and the fact that, oh, they're the greatest, they're the most pure, they have the most powerful form of bending, all of these kinds of false justifications for their empire is manufactured. And I really like how, I think it's the headband episode, maybe it comes right before this or just another one before that one, but it really explores like Fire Nation education system and the kind of myths that they're engendering in their own society about what Fire Nation is, their history, the subjugation and inferiority of other races and bending forms and all of that. And in this episode, we also have a different kind of myth, and that's, you know, a very old-fashioned, traditional, spiritual myth about, you know, a local deity. And the way that these two kind of myths clash, because you have like these firebenders who are trying to destroy everything and build their factory, and then you have this small river spirit who is born from the villagers to like protect against these evil firebenders. But in a sense, both are lies, because Katara takes on the Painted Lady's role and kind of has to force the village into action by appropriating this myth. So then it begs the question, like, how real are myths? How false are myths? Can they be abused in such a way to justify anything? And are there good ways to appropriate a myth like Katara and bad ways to appropriate the myth, kind of like the firebenders?
Yeah, and because I knew we were having this discussion, I did look up the definition of myth just to like have reference to it. And there's two definitions, right? The first is kind of what you were saying, is a traditional story as a way to explain a natural or social phenomenon. And it's usually something supernatural. And the second way that we think of myth is, let's see, the definition here is widely held but false belief or ideas. And I do think that itself is a widely thought of definition of myth, especially in Western cultures, I feel. But I guess, again, as someone who's had experience in both, I wonder whether the truthiness of the myth is even all that relevant, because we see in a lot of, or at least the stories that I was exposed to, like in both Hindu mythology, or I guess I was exposed to Balinese Hindu mythology, Thai with Indonesian stories, it's not the factualness of the story is not actually that relevant, because there's an underlying truth that's like under multiple layers, given the complexity of these stories having been told so many times and being developed over so many generations. Yeah, I don't know, like where do you feel like the truth, factualness, how does that play into this whole mythology discussion?
I like what you said about fact and fiction, like both sort of play a role into the construction of mythology. And I think that's definitely true. Like, I think most myths are born from some kind of fact. You know, maybe there was a real person, for example, like who was the Painted Lady, who then became mythologized, or vice versa. Maybe the Painted Lady was like constructed out of a need to have some sort of guardian or deity. And we don't really know, like, and that's what's really nice about this episode, is they don't really go into any origin story about like who the Painted Lady really is, or like how she came to be. What's most important is the role that she serves for this village. And she's a symbol of hope. She's a symbol of protection, a symbol of strength for the village against other opposing forces like the Fire Nation. even though that's their own people as well. So in a way, Katara does pose a service to the community in sort of reviving the myth and helping the villagers see that they also kind of have a role in myth making, and they have to, like, you know, also, you know, be active figures in perpetuating what the myth represents for them as a people. Like, they also have to defend themselves and clean their own village and maintain that in order for the myth to be revived. And I think there was some theory I read somewhere on the internet that posited that maybe the reason why the Painted Lady can't, like, come help them is because she's the river spirit, and because the river is really dirty. So they think, like, oh, like, maybe that's the reason, like, why she wasn't able to do anything, because she's kind of like, her power was taken away because her river was polluted, right? Which makes so much sense and is really interesting, because it does suggest that it is on the villagers to also maintain the river and make sure that it's clean. Otherwise, she can't exist. So in a sense, the people really do have a role in myth making, and myths are really a construction from the people as much as they are maybe real, however they originated.
Right. And so many, like, holidays that I grew up with involved natural phenomenon or natural, like, waterways, for example, are really, really important places of, they're just very sacred, and keeping that clean is really important to many communities. Yeah, this idea that people have agency to do something. And I'm just thinking of, because we touched on the myth of colonialism, like Fire Nation colonialism specifically. And I guess in that way, we're talking about two different types of myth, right? But there is also, I think, like, an agency in whether we choose to uphold those myths or whether we choose to challenge them and reassess them for ourselves, that I think is important at, like, an individual level, right?
Yeah, I agree. No, that makes total sense. I mean, yeah, it goes back to kind of what I was saying, or what I think we're both kind of coming to in terms of a conclusion, that a myth is, it's not just some kind of isolated, extraneous thing. It's something that requires active participation from the community to perpetuate and to ensure that it continues to live on. Just like kind of how Katara, even though she wasn't the real Painted Lady, she still inspired them to take action, which then revived the real spirit, who was then able to come back and, you know, serve her purpose as their spirit. And it's the same thing when we talk about our other type of myth, which is the manufactured myth of the perfect empire. That also requires active participation and active belief or ignorance, really, on the part of Fire Nation people. And we see that really nicely in the Headband episode as well, where all these, like, kids are learning, basically being brainwashed about history. And you can see, like, there's obvious things that don't really make sense about it. And even Aang's there for a different point of view. But it's the other kids who go with the flow and go with what they've sort of been told. And I think there's always an opportunity in any moment and in these kinds of conflicts where there's different opinions at stake, where you can, like, elect to go along with the myth or just go in a different direction.
Right. And we're talking quite abstractly. Like, this is a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, of course. Sure.
Although, like, you, like, that, yeah, that episode, the Headband episode, is it called the Headband episode? It's
I
not.
Think so. No, I think because he wears, doesn't Aang wear the, it's like the school right. sash, but he wears it to cover his arrow.
Right. But yeah, the idea of even introducing this very, like, hands-on, stifling approach to education, which is also kind of indoctrination that doesn't give a lot of freedom to people. Like, I was rolling my eyes to the back of my head. Like, I'm feeling this a lot, having spent so many years living in Hong Kong and with all the changes that are happening rapidly. Anyway, it's a lot, and it's not just in that area of the world. You know, the West has a lot of examples too. Like, everywhere has examples. Yeah, it affects the citizens. Like, as much as there's this idea that the Fire Nation is perfect and they're spreading their perfectness, this episode and also the Headband episode shows how it's restricting to its own citizens. Creating a social atmosphere where people can't speak out and people can't bring different opinions stifles the individual's ability and even community's abilities, it just takes away their agency, I think.
Yeah, I think this episode does a really good job of representing kind of what an empire / colonialism is like spiritually or at its core. Like you do have this fake, false, perfect vision of empire that they perpetuate, but then you also have like, this is also the Fire Nation, the small decrepit village in the polluted, you know, river with starving people. This is also part of the Fire Nation. So I feel like this episode really highlights that the perfect picture of an empire is not uniform, and that there's always ramifications to it at the spiritual core of it. And that's this gross factory that's spewing out gaseous, nasty pollution into the water. That's like what empire really looks like when you look closer.
Right. And, you know, I didn't double check this, but I keep referring to the factory as this, as a weapons factory. I'm pretty sure that's what it was, but
yeah, okay. I think so. Or iron, at least.
It's yeah, something like that. Yeah. They have molten metal things just kind of lying around at night. But I think like what you said kind of brings me to wanting to talk about the environmentalness of this episode, which I think comes at different levels. And the first level, of course, is a story which I think has been told before about people regaining their agency to transform or to fix or to... Yeah, to mitigate the problems within their own communities, which is in this case, being inspired to clean up the Zhonghui River once the factory has been blown up. And like, oh, environmental, it's clean. And, you know, we're all happy. I think on another level, if we are going to tie in this part of colonialism and the reality of what that means within the colonial powers nation itself, to me is a discussion about the role of Indigenous peoples and of people who have been marginalized from seats of power, because this is a small fishing village that doesn't have a lot of influence. It's pretty isolated. It's if there was a problem, which it seems like there was for a long time, they don't have anyone to complain to that will advocate for them. They don't have a way to express the things that are affecting their community, and it's affecting the food. It's affecting like the health of these people. It's affecting the waterways. And on a national level, the weapons are what's important. That's considered like a more important part to the nation's progression, you know?
Yeah, that's absolutely definitely a very prominent parallel to the plight of Indigenous peoples in the modern world. Like they're just kind of left to deal with the refuse that we produce from our production of, you know, advanced weaponry or modern society, whatever it is. And I think what you said about like how they don't have anyone to advocate for them, that kind of made me think of like, well, it's the Avatar. Like the Avatar is the last person they have. And now I'm thinking, we need an Avatar in this world.
Right.
But who is our Avatar? We don't have one.
Right. Like a single person. Yeah, it's an interesting idea. And definitely, I kind of feel like there's sometimes we sit back because we want to wait for this person or a single entity to come to save us. And if we're looking at the larger environmental issue, specifically of climate change, which is so tied to colonialism and to consumerism and capitalism, it's a really complex issue to unfold. And it's not that any one person can do it, as much as we would love for someone to come in to do it, unless we see ourselves as the Avatar, like every single one of us, and that we have that power.
Like, I love that.
And all the four elements, and like we have that inside us.
That's so true. There's no Avatar in this world, and there's no painted lady in this world who's going to come conveniently sweep everything under the rug and save us and, you know, tie a neat bow over a clean 25-minute episode. This is real world. And so maybe we need a Qatar to inspire us, but in the end, it's on all of us to clean up the river.
Yeah, actually, so that reminds me about Katara and inspiration and, you know, pushing us and everything. So I found this great article written by Corin McCaffrey and, Meyer and Sleen. I think it's an article from 2020 called Transforming the Stories We Tell About Climate Change from Issue to Action. And it kind of highlights the fact that 98% of the climate stories that we're seeing, especially in the news, although also, you know, among discussions and everything, it's like 98% of them are negative. Looking at when we talk about climate change and, oh, it's a climate disaster and we're all going to die and people from the generation before are going to die of old age, but we're going to die of climate change. It's a really paralyzing way to talk about this issue. And most of my academic life has been geared towards learning about this issue. And I went to school for this. And just so everyone knows, you don't learn hope in these classes. They will not teach you that. You learn the technicality. And I came away having to deal with a lot of depression along the way because of how grim the storyline is, even in the academic system. And I am still working on this, but I found so much hope, like, outside of the classroom, learning about the stories of people who have done the work of changing their communities, especially Indigenous peoples, and especially people in communities that are marginalized and underrepresented. But in order to change attitudes, we actually need to start with changing action, because there's this traditional idea of how if you want to change something that you're doing, then you need to first change your attitude. But in practice, it more substantial action starts with actually doing it. And then the ideas that are formed, you learn them along the way and it gets solidified. And since you're already doing the action, you are able to progress to more advanced and more things.
Are you saying that they would have been fine on their own without Kantara's involvement? Like, they would have eventually gotten to work themselves? How does that ideology factor when your belief system essentially states that a mythology will take over and do it for you, you know? So that's where I'm interested. Like, how might that factor into the Avatar world?
Right. I think what's important, so let me just talk a little bit about, like, education entertainment and action-based storytelling, because that's an important way of shifting the dynamic of how we talk about stories. And that is what's, I guess, like, Katara's role in this is, let's just say in this episode, right? The idea is that everything's being polluted and there's this deity who will save the village and looks after the village. That story itself, at least we see how the villagers have been kind of going about things, is one that instills kind of like a passivity. Oh my gosh, in the people. Yeah, as opposed to action, right? And Katara did take on this myth, which is, you know, it was like a deception, essentially. But in her action, the action itself was what seemed to turn and inspire the villagers. And that's kind of like the shift in the storytelling. And when we talk about climate change, it's important to not just focus on the climate issue is what we're seeing, because it can be quite overwhelming and make people freeze up. But actually doing what cartoons have been doing for a long time, where instead of focusing on climate change, they put that as part of the fabric of the reality that they're building. And they show how the characters move through and navigate those environmental challenges. And then it kind of is able to put the audience and inspire the audience in a way that makes them feel like they have more agency. And I mean, it kind of just, while I was reading this, it just reminded me why when I was younger, I loved watching nature documentaries so much, and cartoons, of course. But as I've gotten older, I've essentially stopped watching these documentaries by myself because I get so sad and the eco grief hits really hard. But cartoons, I'll keep watching, and they have environmental messages. Like, we can pick, like, we'll have a whole list.
Yeah, I think that is such a good example of the power of cartoons and why they're so comfortable and familiar for us who, like, we have all of these existential worries about climate change, and even seeing nature documentaries stresses us out because it's so real. It's so close to our real world. It's happening right in front of us, all around us, and being exposed so harshly to that truth is really hard for a lot of us. And that's why cartoons are so great, because they're dealing with all the same stuff, but we are seeing, you know, younger, smarter, you know, cartoony characters deal with those challenges and navigate them in their own way. And that does give us hope. So in a way, you know, Katara is really doing us a service as well.
You love Katara so much.
I
love her, weekly. But like, I love seeing how much you love her.
I do. She is a personal hero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's awesome. Okay, we're gonna go off on a tangent, but I really love all the female characters. Suki mm-hmm. doesn't get enough love, but also yeah, like true. I freaking love Toph. Mm-hmm. Definitely of one of mine, and Azula, and mm-hmm. all the women.
Yeah. We'll have many more episodes focusing yes. on precisely this love for these characters.
Right, exactly. So we're talking about, I guess, the consumption of stories and where the line is on once we start to act on stories. And I guess just like as a summary of what we've been talking about, do you feel like there's somewhat of a line that comes in that makes that you feel is a little more solid, I guess.
So when you say the consumption of stories, do you mean like how we respond to what we watch, or like what particularly?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different types of stories that exist in our life anyway, whether or not we're like reading a book or watching TV. There's also the stories that we tell each other, like we said, about our society, about the realities of like colonialism or whatever. And even like in academia, it's just this like consumption of knowledge and learning. And I feel like there's a tendency to want to just like consume all of these stories and like consume the knowledge and internalize it. But there's a point in which we need to act too. Like there's a myth about, I'm bringing it back to climate change, is that there's an information deficit. And that's a really problematic way that a really problematic narrative, because we've had information about this since the 70s. And there have been people, especially indigenous people and marginalized communities, who have been talking about this before that because they saw the signs. There isn't an information deficit. It's the willingness and the agency towards action. So I guess, how do we define that line?
I see what you're saying. I think, yeah, there is a tendency for those of us, especially our age, like young millennials, Gen Zers, you know, that whole age group, where we just want to kind of forget and just like, you know, consume. And cartoons kind of, they do play to that as well. Like I've spent many summers getting lost in some anime and not really participating in it, in whatever moral or whatever lesson it's trying to teach me, and really just following along for the ride. It is hard to see like exactly where the line is, where a cartoon or a show or whatever it is should inspire us to do something. But I think it's about like listening to like the emotional chord that it strikes. Like I think when we are just mindlessly consuming, you just kind of feel like numb, and that can just lead you to not really emotionally connect with what's happening. But for this show especially, I definitely feel like that the emotion like strike with me. I feel like, you know, the injustice that a lot of the characters feel. I feel the like anger towards the environment and the destruction that I'm seeing on screen, and paralleling that to my own world. So it can be really hard because I think each person's response is different. But I think it's just like important for, you know, everyone and everyone listening to not just go along with the ride, but also always engage with the material and whatever moral lesson is being, you know, taught to us through these shows. Because cartoons, as we said, they do have something to say. So we, as we mentioned, have to participate in the myths as well if we're to keep them alive and going.
And I think that that's a good way to kind of talk about why, or just flesh out why we're doing this podcast in the first place. Because I know that, like you, like I've gotten lost an entire series just watching it passively, and also like in my heart I'm like, oh yeah, that's such an injustice, I need to do this, like this is connected to this, blah blah blah, but then I'm like sitting crocheting in front of the TV. And we talked a lot about this, the two of us, and this podcast for us. And I actually tell people to do this if they're interested in the environment, is that instead of thinking about how everyone else is trying to tackle this climate issue, because the reality is we've been taught that there's a very narrow band in which to engage with environmental issues. It's either environmental action or consumer responsibility, but actually it's way broader than that. I tell people, like, find your lane, find the things that you love, and then imbue that with the environmental knowledge that, or like learn, you know, that platform can be the way that you learn about environmental issues, because it affects everything. And we want to build this platform as a way to like really engage with the material that has like inspired us, but also bring in out like real world connections, because this is important that we talk about these things.
Absolutely. I think there's this whole like hierarchy of media that exists, in which people will, you know, have long, deep discussions about like the meaning of things, and like, I don't know, Game of Thrones or like movies by Francis Ford Coppola and all these highbrow, like amazing, high production value pieces of art. But again, still, cartoons have this stereotype of being mindless nonsense for kids. And I think colorful. That's part of, right, colorful, silly nonsense for kids with, you know, music and dance and big eyes and silly soundtracks. But that's what we're here, I think, to really dispel. There's a lot more to it. We just have to start the discussions, really watch it actively, engage with it as you would some like fancy famous movie like Casablanca or whatever. That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. And, you know, I hope that you guys will stick with us through this. And I guess I want to ask you, Sonia, like, what is your takeaway? But also, if you have any trivia or hot takes, you know, like, what should we take away from this episode? I can actually say my trivia.
Go.
If that helps. So you know that there's that statue of the Painted Lady. She has like a hand gesture. Yeah, and I'm not sure if you saw, but that is the name of her hand, of her like hand positioning, is called the Vitarka Mudra. But essentially it's the gesture of debate, or the discussion mudra, which often statues of the Buddha will have, and it symbolizes when he's doing it, the transmission of his wisdom to his disciples and other people who follow his teachings. And I thought that was like interesting, especially as the way that if we think about our discussion and what this episode has done for us.
Nice. I like that a lot. Yeah. There's definitely a lot of discussion and debate that comes with this episode. Yeah, I guess mine is, I spent a lot of time, just really an inappropriate amount of time, thinking about Doc, Shu, and Bushi, and just like the reason for his character and why the writers made him the way that he is. I was trying to just like understand like the various reasons and theories behind it. So one was that he's supposed to like parallel Katara's identity theft kind of process, or alter ego process. Or secondly, I was like, okay, he's just crazy and this village needs more people, and so he's just taken on three identities. My other theory was that he had two twins or triplet siblings that died from famine or whatever is going on with the village. And he just like filled their emptiness with himself and just like used their hats. But, you know, I never really came to any conclusion, so I would love to hear anyone else's thoughts. Please just send them to us. But there is one piece of trivia, which is that apparently one of his hats, I forget which one, if it's Doc, Shu, or Bushi, but it's the same hat that Aang wears in the Fire Emblem Players episode.
I think it was Shu.
Yeah.
It was Shu's hat.
Yeah, so he wears that hat, which I thought was really funny.
And no one was like thinks that Doc, Shu, Bushi is like an outcast. It doesn't seem like it. Everyone's just kind of around it.
On the contrary, he seems to be like keeping business in this town going. Yeah. He helps them, he sells them,
he's
stuff.
Holding it down.
I mean, he's like the economy of this town, really. Thank you guys so much for listening, for joining us here on this journey, for hearing us simp for Katara and dive into the deep recesses of the meaning of mythology, of colonization, all of these heavy topics that this wonderful, you know, show for kids apparently has really illuminated for us. So yeah. Thanks for joining us on Cartoon Revolution. Episodes drop the last Friday of every month on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and most other major podcast platforms.
Follow us on Instagram at cartoonrevolution.pod. That's cartoonrevolution.pod.
Tell us what you're watching and share your hot takes with us. Music is from The Musical Ghost. See you next time.
See you soon. Mwah. Have a good evening. This is my podcasting voice. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.